everyone. I'm Pam Stack, your host. Welcome to Authors on the Air. We're proud to be part of the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. Tonight, I'm speaking to the daughter of a NASCAR racing legend, Dick Moroso, who started Moroso Speedway, for those of you who follow auto racing. Susan Strecker is his daughter, who grew up around race cars. She grew up around horses, and she grew up riding. I cannot wait for you to meet her. Stay with me, and we'll be right back. I'm so glad you could join me this Wednesday evening. I hope those of you in the cold weather are safe and warm. Those of us down here in Florida are enjoying unseasonably beautiful days. It was 55 when I got up today to work, not a cloud in the sky. Don't be mad, because don't forget we still have summers here. I'm very happy this evening to be talking to Susan Moroso Strecker. I want to tell you a little bit about Susan and how fun it was discovering a little bit about her. She writes on her bio on her website that she was caught between fearing that her bio would be one sentence and wondering how she would ever cram the important parts into the space. So she said the most important thing is that she's married with two amazing kids, and she lives in Essex, Connecticut. And the story of how she met her husband is really great too. So I'm going to just let her tell you about herself. But first, I want to mention that Susan's father, Dick Moroso, was a race car legend. He founded the NASCAR race team, Moroso Racing, and it was very, very well known. To tell you that she hung around, his best friends were Dale Earnhardt Sr. and Richard Petty. So she kind of grew up with racing legends, and now she's making a legend in her own right, a writing legend. I'm pleased to welcome Susan Moroso Strecker to the show. Susan, welcome to Authors on the Air.
Oh, Pam, thank you so much for having me. I've been looking forward to this for months.
I am so happy that you're here, and we have so much to talk about. But the first thing I want to do is talk to you about 25 things. For those of you who know that, you know, I interview all kinds of people, and it's always a riot. I love doing research. It's one of my most fun things. And so besides going to an Amazon author page, I always go to the website and to see what interesting things the authors have to say. Susan Strecker's website, which is Susan Strecker, Strecker.com, Susan Strecker, her website is the most fun reader-friendly website I've ever been on. Seriously, it's a lot more fun than mine. I love this website because she has 25 things listed about herself. And I had said to Susan, if everybody did this, I would have no research to worry about. It would be so much fun. How did you decide to tell 25 things about yourself?
My editor, who is the most loveliest, wonderful, talented person I've ever known in my life, her name is Suzanne Kingsbury, told me to, and I pretty much do everything Suzanne tells me to. I don't even ask why, I just do it, because she's wicked, wicked smart. So she said that it would be a really good way for people to get to know me. I did
really
that.
It really is. It really, really is. So here we're going to talk about 25 things about Susan Strecker, because we're going to talk about her books, you know that, and we're going to talk about her dad, you know that, and we're going to talk about her brother, who she lost in an accident. I understand all those things. Susan and I were separated at birth. She grew up riding horses, so did I. She likes fast cars, so do I. She likes fast men. I mean, she likes nice men, so do I. And
don't
we
tell
each
my
lost
husband.
A brother. So I will. I'm going to tell him that. And you met your husband in a bar. I met mine in a bar. So although I didn't keep mine, but for 20 years. So we're going to talk. I don't think there's a shelf life past that, at least for the second time around. Anyway, I love the fact that you said something very interesting. You started off your 25 things list by saying you think that things taste the way other things smell. You
totally.
Talked away. You said milk tastes the way Band-Aids smell, and star fruit tastes the way hotels smell. Explain that.
I can't, and it shocks me that not everybody thinks the way that I do, because it's true. I don't like milk. I don't eat, yesterday morning I was getting milk out for, my kids or something, and it had been sitting in there in a while, and I think the expiration date was the day before, and I thought, oh, God, do I poison my children with bad milk, or do I suck it up and taste it? So I smelled it, like normal people do, and it just, milk is gross. Milk always smells sour to me, so I tasted it, and I knew it wasn't sour or bad because it tasted like Band-Aids. Like, it shocks me that this is not how the rest of the people in the world experience life. Like, some things just taste the way other things smell. And my daughter my daughter's name is Ainsley, and she's a total mini-me. She looks just like me. Unfortunately for me, a lot of the time she acts just like me too, which is going to come back to haunt me when she's a teenager.
Yes,
it
will.
And she's,
yes, it will.
Flipping me off to get an, Vinny Bag of Donuts Camaro. And she thinks that some things smell the way some things taste the way other things smell too. So in all the people I've met in my whole wide world of life, she's the only one who gets me. Totally. Star fruit smells like hotels. I mean, tastes like hotels. There's something else, I can't remember what it is, but I remember it tasting like the way that old lady's perfume smells, which, believe me, was not a pleasant experience.
That's so funny.
Yeah.
Well, you also have another coffee. You have another food thing, and that is you like the taste of coffee yogurt, but you don't like coffee.
I love coffee yogurt, and every, probably 3 years, I try to convince myself that I'm a grown-up now and I have to like coffee. And if I put in, a half a cup of coffee and maybe a cup and a half of cream and, 3 or 4 pounds of sugar, then I can take it. But, yeah, not so much. And I also don't like coffee ice cream, which you can't imagine that there's probably that big of a difference between coffee yogurt and coffee ice cream. I could eat, along with peanut butter Captain Crunch, I could eat coffee yogurt for the rest of my life. But coffee, it's like bacon. Like, I love the way
Captain
it smells,
Crunch.
But I don't like it. I'm sorry?
Well, peanut butter Captain Crunch, when you said that was your absolute one of your most favorite things in the whole wide world, that you could die and go to heaven on Captain Crunch, peanut butter Captain Crunch, I thought, really? Really? Well, maybe that's why you're so sweet, because you eat that sweet cereal. But I thought that was really funny, too. Because I'll take a teaspoon of peanut butter if I need to get, a jolt of energy. But I don't want peanut butter and jelly. I don't want sweet cereals or anything like that. So it's really strange. Go ahead. Tell me.
No, you go.
No. It's your show, baby. You talk.
Oh, well, in that case, you're going to listen to me as I talk more about cereal.
Okay.
And you're going to like it.
Okay.
I was a vegetarian for 12 years because the idea of eating little baby murdered animals really grosses me out. And there's a very ironic twist to the story. But I think I went vegetarian maybe my senior year in high school. So all 4 years of college, I was vegetarian. And one of the best things I can say about my little university, Drew University in Madison, New Jersey, is that it had a cereal bar with 32 different flavors of cereal. And that is what I ate for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. No joke, for 4 years.
Oh my God. And you just are the perfect size. All pictures show you as just being absolutely lovely. and adorable. You're not overweight. You're not skinny.
No, no,
you're
those are clearly
perfect.
Very old pictures. No, do we? And, you know, and I, you know, I had the metabolism of a 20-year-old. You know, when I was 20. Now I'm 45.
Right.
Yeah, not so much.
It's catching up, right? That's a great story. And just to let you know, there, you know, Speedway. Interestingly enough, gas. I don't know if you have a Speedway where you are. But they have a yogurt bar, so just
really,
everything in this world is connected. I'm convinced of it, Susan. Yes, they have a yogurt bar, and you can put cereal toppings on your yogurt if you want, or miniature M&Ms. Or, and I know it's wonderful. So one day when you come to Florida, I'll take you to the Speedway gas station for, you know, breakfast or something. It'll be a treat.
Well, all right.
You talk a lot in your 25 things about horses and cats. And so I love those things. I think that those things are really cool because you grew up with horses and you have a cat named Terrible Cat. Why did your kids name your cat Terrible Cat?
Because she's a terrible cat. She's a terrible cat. She's a good dog. She follows us down to the bus stop every day and waits for my kids to get on the bus. And then she sits in the window of the dining room and watches, you know, waiting for the bus to come. And then she'll go down to the bus stop with me to get them off the bus in the afternoon. She eats anything, like anything, you know, the kids or I drop on the floor. So she's a very good dog, but she's a terrible cat. She's mean to her little cat sister. She, you know, jumps on people for no good reason. She's pretty nice to people, but I want a Siamese cat, and I want to name it Cheddar. Don't ask me why. And I can't get Cheddar until damn Terrible Cat goes to heaven or wherever terrible cats go because terrorize it.
I will tell you, you're going to be sorry to have a Siamese because they won't shut up. I have one that's part Siamese. All mine are rescues, so they just don't shut up. I mean,
I've had three. I grew up with Siamese cats. I had one when I was little named Mindy, I think probably from Mork and Mindy. And then I had another one named Willie, who was awesome. And then for my 21st birthday, I got another one named Riley, and he was the best cat in the world. And I think the reason why I want another Siamese cat is because Kurt, my husband, we've been together for 21 years, and in all the animals, including our children, that we've had, Riley has been the only one that loved me more. I came into the relationship with animals, and they defected from my camp and went to him. And it makes me mad. So I'm convinced that if I get another Siamese cat, that it will love me more than it would love Kurt.
Okay, there
and
you
that
go.
Would make
well, that
me
makes
happy.
Sense to me. That makes sense to me. Okay, so you have a really good memory for very certain things. For you say useless trivia. I'm the queen of minutia, so I understand that and appreciate it. But you have a good memory for numbers, facts, and dates. I have zero memory for dates. And you said, but besides that, despite that, you have a hard time recognizing faces. And you think everybody is the same person. There is a medical condition that makes that happen.
The layperson's word for it is face blindness.
Yes. Is that what you have?
I probably not. I probably don't fit the criteria for it, like, in clinical terms. And I'm trying to – it's called, like, aphasia or something in real medical terms.
Right.
But the common name for it is face blindness. I probably don't qualify for it in the medical world. But you also have to understand where I live. And I live in this teeny tiny little town, like 3,000 people, right on the Connecticut River in Connecticut, obviously, called Essex. Mm-hmm. And it's this beautiful little town and has an amazing school system. And my kids have, you know, these great friends. And I'm friends with, you know, some of the parents of my kids' friends. And it's really just, and we have this little town center where we have parades for everything. We had a Groundhog Day's parade, and in honor of Carrie Fisher, they dressed up their great big groundhog like Princess Leia. So we have these great, great parades, and it's a wonderful town. I'm sorry?
It's like a book. It's like
it is. It totally is. It totally is. But everybody in my town looks the same. They're all these. All the moms are like these skinny, beautiful, teeny tiny blonde women. And I don't ever call anybody by name unless they're with their children, because I can usually tell the kids apart, but I can never tell the moms apart because they all look alike. I'm convinced they're all the same people. So maybe I do have face blindness, or maybe I just live in like a parallel universe where everybody is the same person. I don't know. I haven't figured it out yet.
Stepford, right? Isn't it Stepford, Connecticut?
It totally is. Yeah, it reminds me of Jennifer Weiner, is one of my favorite authors, and she wrote a book called Goodnight Nobody in a town very similar to the town that I live in, and ironically it's set in Connecticut. And yeah, I think I live in that town because everybody looks the same. It's just like one beautiful woman after another, and I'm like that thing from Sesame Street, like which one of these is not like the other. Like I walk into school pickup with 100 other mothers, and I'm like, oh yeah, there she is, there's that Strecker woman. Yeah, no, not the same.
You're too funny.
Yeah, that's me.
You told me, you said in 25 Things that the producers of Wife Swap contacted you about appearing on the show. Of course, you declined. How in the world and why in the world would they contact you?
Because I'm wicked funny, and why not?
Well, I know you are.
No, they actually wanted to do, and I've never seen the show, but I understand the concept. They wanted to do a show on women in racing. And so they contacted me. I guess they, probably this was a long time ago. They probably Googled me and sent me an email asking me to be on their show. And I was like, no way in hell. Like,
yeah, really.
I would not subject my children and my husband to some other rant. And you know that they probably put like the worst possible, pairing together. So there's just that I could not inflict, somebody else on my family. And let's face it, nobody except for Kurt and my kids would want to live with me. So, yeah, no.
Well, that's too funny.
But it made for an interesting fact of 25 things.
It does make for an interesting 25 things. So another food thing that you apparently like Baby Ruth. Tell everyone why.
I actually don't like Baby Ruth candy bars, but I do like fat and sugar are my two favorite foods in the world, next to peanut butter Captain Crunch, which is pretty much all fat and sugar. So I love candy. I have a wicked, wicked sweet tooth. And when Jeff Gordon, who just retired, I think last year, he was a very, very, very famous Winston Cup or Nextel Cup or Sprint Brownie
whatever it's called now,
Monster Energy Drink Cup. He was a very famous driver before he moved up to what was then Winston Cup, and he drove in the Busch Series. He was sponsored by Baby Ruth candy bars. And my friend Debbie was friendly, like pretty friendly with him. And so when I would hang out with Debbie at races, we would hang out in his trailer, in his transporter, for the free candy. Because I really like candy. And whatever company owns Baby Ruth also makes other kinds of candy. So I didn't have to actually eat the Baby Ruth candy, but there's lots of other candy that I could just like dig through these giant vats of candy. It was like Halloween. Every day with Jeff Gordon was Halloween. It was awesome.
Oh, my God. That's so funny. I guess we should talk about your books, because I want to leave some surprises for everyone to go to your website and look at. You have two books. One is called Night Blindness and one is called Nowhere Girl. Where do you want to start?
Oh, let's start smack in the middle. I don't know where that is.
Okay. Well, I've got two. You don't have the third one's not in print yet, is it?
No, I'm actually on my fifth one. I'm in the middle of writing my fifth one. Three is with my agent. She's shopping it to publishers. And four is actually with my husband, who is reading it now to tell me if it sucks or not.
I love that. I think it's great. Okay, let's start with book number one. Go. Elevator pitch.
Okay. It is – no, I'm so bad at that. It's called Night Blindness, which is named after a David Gray song.
Synopsis. Okay.
I'm really bad at that. It's like I can do the TV guide synopsis, like of Top Gun, like, pilot loses friend in crash. let's see, Night Blindness.
Okay,
accidentally kills brother and feels guilty.
Wow.
There you go for Night Blindness.
That's about it. That's really about it. So here's the thing. She really, this is kind of a redemption kind of a book, except for the fact that she's got to go through a lot of stuff. Not only is she consumed with guilt because of this horrible accident, but she also has to deal with a very serious illness that her father faces, and returns to her childhood home. I think going home is difficult at the best of times, regardless of if you had a good childhood or a not good childhood. Where did you get this idea from? Where did the thought of going home come to you? How did you know that's what you were going to do?
I will tell you two very important things about my books, and I imagine the first one probably holds true for everybody out there that writes. From the very first draft of what was Night Blindness, and its original name was Linger, which I know is terrible.
There's a group of books called Linger, it's not a terrible name.
No,
there's
it was
a
also
whole series of books called Linger.
It's also a song by the Cranberries. And I do
it
love
is.
Music, and everything in my life revolves around apparently food and music, and maybe a
there
terrible
you
cat.
Go.
So when my very first draft of Night Blindness was not at all what it is now. It was about a girl who was very, very close with her parents, and her father was sick, and that was it. Like, I don't even think there was a brother. I don't think she had ever moved away. But, you know, there's through the many, many renditions and rewritings and revisions and drafts and edits and everything else, there's like a whole big blue ocean between the very first draft of it and what is now in bookstores. So the evolution of Jenny moving away and then having to come home because her father is ill and the accident with her brother was just layers upon layers upon layers of brainstorming with Suzanne, my genius editor, and, you know, just drafts of writing and rewriting and rewriting to try to make it really an interesting story. Like, ooh, what else can we – I call it the kitchen sink approach. Well, what else can we throw
sure.
in there to make it a book that somebody will want to read? And then I inevitably, you know, throw the whole kitchen sink in, or more like the whole kitchen, and then I spend, you know, 6 or 7 or 25 rewrites taking the kitchen sink out, you
out.
Know, piece by piece and living – leaving –
sure.
Yeah, leaving pieces in that I think will work. So that's the piece that I think most writers can probably relate to. The second half of where I go with my books is I never know, literally, from one moment to the next, every time I open my computer, what's going to happen in a story. I never do an outline. I never think about my characters. I never know how my endings are going to happen. Ever. Like, I had to rewrite the ending to Nowhere Girl 9 times before I got it right because somebody had to kill this poor girl and I didn't know who it was. But in Night Blindness, the whole evolution of Jenny having to come home, I think eventually happened a little bit naturally because, like what you just said, it is hard to go home, especially when you're an adult and you have a difficult relationship
sure.
with your parents, which I don't. You know, and you have ghosts from your past, which I do. You know, I think we all do.
Sure.
You know, it's a hard thing to come home and to face up to something that has really dictated your entire life. And that's
absolutely.
What this book was about. And what the point that I really wanted to get across as I wrote it, and it kind of showed itself to me organically, was the way that secrets and shame can change somebody's life. I mean, if she had just told the truth, her entire life would have been different. Her entire life would have been something that it didn't
seems
have to be
like
if she had just told the
answer,
truth.
But, you know, yeah, it seemed in retrospect, you think, how easy would it have been? But the fact of the matter is, and I maybe as a writer you get this when someone says this, but I firmly believe you make choices based on the best information you have available and where you are in that space and time. So, yeah, telling the truth seems like a pretty easy thing, But then again, you don't know what the circumstances are and why someone is compelled not to be totally honest. So, you know, like you said, the guilt, the overwhelming guilt, the shame, everything else goes along with it. So it's interesting to me. How did you decide to write a book, Susan?
I like to blame my mom, you know, because it's always the parents' fault.
Sure.
The very long answer is when I was little, I spent a lot of time on fishing boats with my family, and my dad was a huge fisherman, like lived for the water. And we spent a lot of time fishing, and I hate fish. I hate water. I don't particularly love boats. I have an unnatural fear of water. I'm pretty sure that I drowned in the last life. I mean, it's freaky, especially when the sun goes down and it's dark. Like, I won't come out from, you know, down below. It's like, it terrifies me. So family vacation spent on these big fishing boats with chum and blood and guts and disgusting things and eating these poor little fishies that would probably rather be swimming around in the ocean was not really my idea of fun. So my mom would bring a notebook and a pencil, and she'd tell me to write stories about my adventures, which I'm pretty sure, looking back with, you know, hindsight, was just her way of getting me off her back, you know, keeping me entertained because I was so miserably unhappy. You know, oh, and I also get seasick. So I think that was just her way of trying
to
keep
like
me entertained.
You're like a bonus kid, aren't you? You're just the life of the party.
Super fun.
Wow.
Super fun.
But you know something? She may have been trying to keep you from bothering her and keep you occupied, but she did you a huge favor, didn't she?
She did. And I say, you know, get me off her back, tongue in cheek, because my mom is the most, like, totally hands-on, lives for her children. What can she do to make us happy, even now at 45? You know, my mom was never like, go away, kid, kind of the way that I am with my kids sometimes. She was never like that with us. So as soon as I could write, like, I think I remember my first story. I was probably in first grade. And it was like,
wow.
There once was a girl. Wow. She went on a boat. She hated boats. She cried a lot. The end. You know, it was something like that. I've always liked to write. So it was something that I went to this very hippie, alternative, unusual high school, and we didn't really have a whole lot of classes where we went, but they would let us like make up our own shit. You said I could swear. I would take a writing, I made up my own like creative writing course. And I did that with some of it was very, very crunchy. I basically did a tutorial, of creative writing, and I still have a lot of my stories from high school, and they're so horribly dreadful, like so dreadful. And then one of the reasons why I chose Drew University in New Jersey to go to college is because they were the only school that I applied to that had a writing program. And so I was a psychology major, but I was a writing minor. And it was just something that I really loved to do. And I worked for a newspaper for a couple summers after I graduated from college. And I'm a terrible, terrible, terrible nonfiction writer, like terrible. But it was just never really something that I thought I would do. And then I went to graduate school and got a master's degree in marriage and family therapy. And I was a therapist for a couple of years. And then my dad had the very poor taste to get a terminal illness. And so I split and left Connecticut and went to Florida and took care of him for a year and a half until he died. And then I went off in a different direction and kind of followed in his footsteps for a while. And then when my kids started school, I wanted to be home because the job that I had required a lot of travel, and I wanted to be home. So while I was home with my kids, I started writing. I just thought it would, you know, in my 2 hours of free time while they were in kindergarten and preschool, I felt like I should either get a real job and go back and be a therapist. And after going through what I went through when my dad was sick, I thought I'd probably end up working in a hospital being a grief therapist. But I started writing instead. And I think looking back, it was probably my therapy. I think it was the way that I dealt with my grief from losing my dad. And
writing is very cathartic, there's no doubt. Regardless if you write about your trauma or not, it is a very cathartic thing for sure. So did you enjoy being a marriage counselor?
I did. I liked it a lot. I didn't get to do it for as long as I would have liked, because, like I said, my dad got sick, and, you know, family always comes first. But
absolutely,
most therapists will tell you that they hate doing couples therapy. Couples therapy is kind of like nailing Jell-O to a tree. It's very, very difficult because you're dealing with two people, you know, two totally different personalities at the same time. And, you know, a lot of times they kind of hate each other, which is why they're in therapy. And
sure.
I freaking loved it. I loved it. I think if I had stayed, I probably would have opened, you know, hung a shingle and gone into private practice with mainly with couples. So, yeah,
really?
I did love it. Yeah, yeah. I don't know why. I really loved it.
Oh, well,
it's kind of weird.
Great. So you have a particular brand of insight into personality that a lot of people don't, because you enjoyed it so much too. So you got a lot out of it, and I would imagine that helps in your writing when you are writing from different POVs, because unless your books are strictly from a single point of view, which is very unusual, but it could happen. Do you feel like what you learned in your practice has helped your writing?
I think it helps tremendously. You know, both my books are, I don't particularly love this term, but I'll use it for lack of a better one, are kind of family dramas. You know, in the first book, there's a dead brother and there's an ill father. And in the second book, there's a dead sister, and kind of a whacked out family that never really talked about the loss. And so I do think that having a background in psychology and being intimately familiar with marriage and family therapy, and kind of the pathologies of being a human, I think it comes in very, very handy, because you have to understand your characters and how they relate to the world and how they are in space, and in relationship with each other and their families, and also how the reader, you know, whenever you open a book, no matter what kind of book it is, whether it's a mystery or a thriller or a chick lit or, you know, whatever, you
right.
kind of go on a journey with those people. And so I think the relationship between the characters within the story and also between the reader and the characters is very, very important. And so my degree, I think, helped tremendously. And the whole point of my second book is that everybody deals with grief differently. And one thing, my advisor in graduate school, her name was Barbara Lynch, and she was like one of those mind-boggling genius type people, and a lot of what she said,
right.
I would just look at her like, huh? And it took me a long time to understand a lot of what she said. One thing she told us, it was on a Wednesday night, about 8:30, and this will, you know, goes back to my memory for useless details. She said, death doesn't end, death only ends a life. It does not end a relationship. And I thought, what the hell does that mean? And it took me probably, I'm not kidding, probably 10 years to figure it out. And that is such a huge part of my second book, because this girl named Katie is a survivor, a surviving identical twin. Her twin sister Savannah was murdered like 18 years before the book opens. And she still has this very active relationship with her dead sister, not in like the weird, like I see dead people way, but because her sister, because Katie is still alive, her sister Savannah is still very much a real part of her life.
With an identical twin, it would be. Absolutely.
Yeah, exactly. And that part of the story came directly from what Barbara taught us. So, yeah, I absolutely think it comes in extremely handy.
And also, don't you think, Susan, that when you lose a sibling or even a parent at an early age, but a parent, you know your parent is going to pass away at some point, and both my parents have died. But, you know, I lost a brother when he was 19, and it becomes your new normal. And But that doesn't mean I don't think about him all the time, right? Does that sound
absolutely
crazy?
No, oh my God, we are like soul sisters. No, absolutely. And another thing that I learned in graduate school that I think holds very true for life and in books is that normal isn't normal. Normal is what you know. You know,
right.
So if you grow up in a
right.
world where your sibling meets a tragic end, or your parents get divorced when you're little, or, you know, the way mommy and daddy solve their arguments is to beat the snot out of each other. And believe me,
right.
I worked with a lot of families that was their normal. You know, that was very, very,
right.
very far away from normal for me. But that was their
right.
normal. Like, what do you mean you don't do that?
Right.
Like, everybody does that because it's what you know. So
right.
absolutely, it
right.
does become the new normal, and it becomes your identity in a way because it is all that you know.
And it's not a bad thing. I mean, it's so interesting you're talking about, you know, spouses who beat each other up. I'm a survivor of domestic violence, but I'm also a victim advocate. I have been for about 25 years now. So I work with battered women. Yeah, thanks. So, you know, so I'm understanding exactly where you kind of, God, it's like we're destined to meet. I really believe that. There are no coincidences in life. I keep saying this over and over again. But yes, you're right. I think that your new normal does not mean it's abnormal. It just is different. It's just different. You've adjusted and accommodated. And so you have a lot of tools that make you adjust to your new normal in a good way or a not so good way. You know, how well you've always dealt with trauma in the past, or what your support system is like. Do you recover well enough? Are you mentally and physically strong and emotionally strong? So I like the themes that you're talking about. I like the themes in your books. And I was thinking about how would I explain your books to someone if I had to ask for a genre, and all I can say is it's fiction. I can't put them into a category. They're suspenseful fiction, but like you said, they're kind of family drama oriented. Is that right? I mean, I don't want to say family drama. I just think they're fiction. Is that okay?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. My second book, much to my surprise, has been tagged by some as a thriller. Which is not at all what, or a crime novel, which is not at all what I would have described it as, but okay. That's what you want to call
it.
Sure.
If someone wants to read it that way, that's fine. I just find your work is very literary and in a very good way, not with all the angst and, you know, that stuff that you have to be like really educated to read it because, you know, otherwise I'm screwed. But,
you and me both.
It feels really real. The stuff in your book feels real to me. So when I was reading, and especially when I read Nowhere Girl, I can relate to night blindness. Because I can relate to sibling loss. But I liked reading Nowhere Girl, and I understood your character very well. I understood what happened. And so here's what I want to ask you. How hard was it for you to write, I'm talking just about Nowhere Girl, in first person? Because you
did
hard
also at
all. Night blindness. And you don't write in first person present. You do write, in some cases you do, but for the most part, because it's very difficult for a lot of readers to read in first person present, but your writing is very smooth. Do you ever read your dialogue out loud when you're writing? Or any of your
every day.
Of your book?
Every day.
Really? It
My
must be why it feels
teacher.
Very silky to me. It must be why it feels very silky smooth to me, that it doesn't feel harsh. Sometimes first person is very harsh. It's difficult to read. I don't find your books that way at all. It's a very soft, it's a melodic read, I think is what I'm trying to say.
Oh, well, that's a lovely way of describing it. Thank you.
You're welcome.
No, first person is all I can write. Like, if you asked me to write a book in third person, you'd be like, oh, my God, who is this joke? I don't think
right.
I could write in the third person, and I don't know why. It's just something I've always done. And my eighth grade English teacher, Mr. Hirschnick, who really was the other person other than my mom responsible for me becoming a writer, used to tell us, he had a list called the Hirschnickian Rules of Writing. And I would think I was
that.
In eighth grade in, I don't know, maybe 1983. and I still have my Hirschnickian rules of writing. And one of them was to read out loud. And I say I do a lot of editing for people, and that is my golden rule. My number one rule is read your work out loud, because the cadence, I cannot tell you how many brilliant Pat Conroy, Jodi Picoult passages I write in my head. And then I read them out loud. I'm like, what the freak? You know?
I know.
And then I delete them all.
You know, I have this conversation with a lot of my guests, and I'll tell you why. Because I think that the downfall, or the downside, I should say, of not reading your own dialogue is if you're a female writing a male POV, I don't want your male character to be talking like a woman. I don't want him using words that a woman would say. I want the timbre and the cadence, all of those things should be totally male-centric. And vice versa, if a man is writing from a woman's POV, there are certain things women are just not going to say. And and you know it. So they use different words. Their tone is different. The voice is completely different. If you have characters saying, I mean, some books I read, you know, 400 books a year, Susan, okay? So
Holy crap.
Are some books that I'll, yeah, I know, but I don't have a TV and I have no life. So, you know, my life is talking to writers. That's the most important thing I do. I love writers. So I will throw a book away. I mean, just throw it away, meaning I'll just throw it. I'm just done. If I'm reading something where a man, you know, says something, it sounds so ridiculous to me that I know no alpha male would ever say a line like that. And I'm thinking, you're taking me out of the story now. You're taking me out of the story. And as a reader, that's like the mortal sin. It's a kiss of death as far as I'm concerned. Because guess what? There are 5 million books on Kindle right now, and I can go and get another book. You, in the meantime, author person, who took me out of the story, have lost a sale, you know, and have lost a review, quite honestly. So, you know, treat me with respect as a reader. And I think your books do that. It's really nice. It's very refreshing. Thank you for that.
Thank you for saying that.
Yeah, you don't tell me what to think of the story. You've written your story. You let me interpret it the way I want, and I can hear all these different voices. That's real important. Before we do anything next, I want you to tell everyone where they can find you on the webs, please.
On the web?
Yeah, on the internet and social media and all those things.
Gotcha. You can go to my website, and it's Susan Strecker, SusanStrecker.com. I'm also on Facebook. I have an author page, Susan Strecker. I have a very interesting Twitter handle, which is at Susan Strecker. I try to make it as easy as possible for people to find me.
And I will tell you that Susan does respond. She doesn't have, I mean, her husband's not sitting and writing back and all that. You can actually talk to her. She's a real person. So it's really cool because she was recommended by readers to come on my show. And she actually wrote back to me when I wrote to her, which was nice. It was wonderful. And you can get all of her books everywhere. Wherever you buy books, they are available there. And I urge you to sign up for her blogs, because surviving suburbia is one of the funniest things I've ever read in my life. It is hysterical when you read her blogs. You've got to sign up. You're going to love them.
Really. Thank you. I am very funny, especially when, you know, somebody has slighted me or, you know, mistaken me for the dog walker when I'm in Palm Beach, Florida, to do an appearance at a bookstore. I drove into this gated community, and the guy was like, oh, are you the dog walker? I'm like, yes, that's me. I'm here to walk the dog. Yeah, so my blogs are, most of them are very, very funny. I do have a couple of serious, not so funny ones up there. And I don't blog as often as I should. But the problem with that is that I can only blog when the moment strikes me. And usually it's when somebody's being mean to me. So I guess the moral of the story is nobody's been mean to me lately.
Oh, well, that's good. I'm glad to hear that. So I know I told you 30 minutes and we've gone way over that, but I have to do final five with you. Five quick questions and five quick answers. Are you game?
Oh, please.
Okay, good. Well, see, you're perfect for this because you'll say something ridiculous and I'll love it. Okay, so I already know you said music is a huge part of your life. If you were going to go to a deserted island, what three bands would you take with you? Their music, you know, which bands would you take with you?
I would take Van Morrison, Crosby, Stills, and Nash, and Bruce Springsteen.
Oh, my God, I love you, except I wouldn't take Bruce Springsteen. I'd take Stevie Wonder. How cool is that?
I had a horse named Superstition, named after Stevie Wonder's song Superstition.
Really?
I did.
I might have to take Pavarotti, but the other ones, I'm so with you. Crosby, Stills, and Nash. Oh, yes, of course. Absolutely.
Of course.
You knew that right away. Now, do you read a lot? As much
I do.
As I know you probably can't read as much as you want to read because you're busy writing. What's your favorite genre?
Anything that Pat Conroy had ever written in his life.
Oh,
he could write a note to his children, and I would read it religiously.
I'm telling you, I'm like that with Jeffrey Deaver. He could write on a sticky note. And I
oh, The Bone Collector.
I love. Yes.
I did not get
so
in a cab
wonderful.
For a year after The Bone Collector, after I read The Bone Collector.
Really? You're so funny.
Oh, my God. Not for a year.
He's coming up.
Freaking...
He's going to be on next month because the Burial is out now. So, and I love Jeff. He's great. But I am a Pat Conroy fan also. To me, The Prince of Tides was the most beautiful book ever written. I read that
ever.
Book once a year, whether I need it or not. Yes, really, truly.
Yes.
Fantastic
yes.
Southern writer. And I was going to tell you, on your 25 things, you have to change the last one, obviously.
I know. I never got a chance to lick
heart.
Him.
I know.
I cried hysterically. He died my launch party for my second book. And I woke up the next morning horribly hungover and with no sleep, and somebody had texted me that he had died in the night, and I cried hysterically. Yeah, I'm so sad I never got the chance to lick him.
So whose book is on your nightstand then?
Right now, I'm a little behind the times. I'm reading Patricia Cornwell's newest Kay Scarpetta novel. It's called Chaos.
Very good. Very good.
She's kind of like
another
an old faithful to me.
Sure. Yes, she is with me too. And Sue Grafton is another one. She's coming out with Y this year, so I'm really excited about that. Okay, so we know about your love of horses. We know you have Terrible Cat. We know your music choices. We know your book choices. You have two children. Are either of your kids creative by any chance? Because you have a lot of energy and you're very creative. A lot of times it's genetic. Have you passed your creativity on? Or is your husband creative as well?
No. He's not. I love him to death, but
you know.
Yeah, not really.
Too bad.
My
bad,
husband.
Bud, you're not creative.
My husband is like my dad, though. Kurt is probably one of the freakiest, smartest people I've ever met, like super freaky smart, like my dad was. My dad was a literal genius. And so a lot of times, like trying to have a conversation with Dick Moroso, it was like talking to a Martian. Like, I'm sorry, what? Like, and sometimes I find that with talking to Kurt, too, because he's just so freaking smart. My kids, interestingly about my kids, is neither one of them particularly loves to write, but they both, when they have to do it, they're both very, very creative. My son, a couple of years ago, he's 13, he's in seventh grade, Cooper. A couple of years ago, he had to write poetry for school, and oh God, I feel your pain, son. Like I can't write. I couldn't write a dirty limerick if I had to. Okay, I could.
Yes, you could.
But
you could.
Yeah, of course. He wrote a poem that I still have called "Red," and it was about like what emotions the word and the color red evokes in him. And it, I have to tell you, it was just beautiful. And my daughter Ainsley, yeah, it really was beautiful. My daughter Ainsley will just tell these fantastical stories when she has to do creative writing for school. She's in fifth grade. She's 11. She's like me. Cooper is too. They both ride. They both have ponies. But Ainsley especially is like just her whole world is her pony. His name is James, and he's perfect. She tells these amazing, fantastical stories about James, and she also loves Adele because, you know, really, who doesn't love Adele? I'm kicking Springsteen off my island, and I'm taking Adele, and I would like to like her. Any part of her.
Sorry, Bruce. Next question. What's your favorite food of all time besides peanut butter Captain Crunch? I mean, if you go out to a restaurant, chances are, what are you going to order?
Oh, in a restaurant? I was going to say chocolate. What I would want to order, because they're two very separate things.
What would you want to order?
I love pasta. I love pasta primavera. Love it. I also love fried chicken. For somebody who was a vegetarian for 12 years, the first thing I ate when I fell off the vegetarian wagon was fried chicken from a mobile gas station.
That's so funny. There's a really good article today in Mind Body Green today about falling off the vegetarian wagon and how it's okay. And it usually happens after about 10 or 11, 12 years. It's so funny that you said that. I swear to God.
Yeah, it was. I think it was 12 years for me.
Yeah, it's a very common thing, and it's really interesting that you say that. My final question to you is my favorite one I ask every single guest. So Kurt and the children and I are writing a book about your life. We need a title. I know.
Oh, no.
We need a title. Yeah, what are we going to title the book about your life?
Well, in keeping with songs, because my life revolves around music and all my books are named after songs, and most of my horses have been named after songs. And if Kurt would have let me, I would have named my kids, you know, Roxanne from The Police and Hey Joe from Hendrix.
Right.
I would say it has to be Fat Bottom Girls by Queen.
All right. I love that. That's perfect for you. I love it.
It is.
Susan Strecker, I have had the most fun talking to you. We didn't touch on near enough subject. There's so much more to go.
Then you have to have me back.
I will do that. When the next book is out, you are on. Deal?
Oh, you're the best.
I think you are.
Awesome.
Thank you for being
I would love that. Thank
tonight.
You so much for having me on, Pam. This was
a
ball.
I've had a great time. Thanks so much,
me
Susan.
Too.
Have a good weekend. All right. Talk to you. Bye.
Thanks, Pam. Bye-bye.
Bye. And that's our show for tonight, folks. I hope you have a really good week. I'm off on Friday because it is Southwest Readers Fest. That's a big weekend event for me. And my friend, award-winning author, best-selling author, Libby Fisher-Hammond, will be staying with me. And we're doing Literary Fest all weekend long. Have a great week, everybody. Read a good book. And thank you, Mom and Dad. Good night.